What is creation? So that's what my lecture is devoted to. John Webster asserts the starting point for a Christian doctrine of creation, as for any Christian doctrine, is God in himself, or theology, as Bonaventure says, begins at the very beginning, which is the first principle. Only out of the sheer antecedent perfection of God's life in himself can we feel the force of the concept of creation. I think that's very profound. The starting point for a Christian doctrine of creation, as for any Christian doctrine, is God. Now, in order to define what creation is, we must know something of the Creator. And I hope to further display this in the discussion this morning. What I'd like to do is give a basic definition of creation, then some definitions of creation by Reformed theologians in the 17th century, just three examples, and then interact with two contemporary authors, time permitting, that I think speak in ways that the older guys didn't. And so I'm going to provide some pushback there. So here's my basic definition of creation. What is creation? Now, quite often, I think this is your experience as well, when asked the question, everyday Christians would immediately direct attention to what has been made. What is creation? Look at X, Y, or Z. Look at the beauty and the magnificence of the ocean and the depth and the mystery of it. And what's in your state that's famous? The Grand Canyon, that's right. That thing of beauty must have something behind it or someone behind it that caused it to come into being and has preserved it and all those things. We might say, you know, look at the vast sky above with the moon and the stars and the sun and the clouds which give rain from heaven. We could point to the ocean, as I said before, the majesty of the Grand Canyon, all those things. And that's not necessarily a wrong answer to the question, what is creation? But if you read, and you should read, and if you don't, you need to start, especially older writers on the doctrine of God and doctrine of creation, their answers to that question aren't real horizontal. They don't go out from themselves and say, well, look at this, look at that which has been made. Their answers are more theological. They give a more theocentric answer to the question. And this is certainly due to the fact that they're theologians, okay? They should do that. That's what they got paid for. That's what they lived for, and that's what they wrote for. But if we ponder the question, what is creation, a bit more in depth, then think about how the Bible presents to us the account of creation in Genesis 1. Our answer should start with God and go out from there. For example, when defining the doctrine of creation, Bovink says, creation is that act of God through which, by his sovereign will, he brought the entire world out of non-being into being that is distinct from his own being. It's very, very important. Notice that Bovink begins his definition in a theocentric manner. Creation is an act of God, a divine effect. Bovink's definition is important, for it clearly upholds a creator-creature distinction that must be maintained all throughout our accounting for the divine economy. Creation is of another order of being from divine being. Divine being is created being comes into existence by God. So there are two orders of being, we could say. Created being and non-created or divine being. The former, created being, is finite. It has bounds or limits according to its created capacities. The latter, divine being, is infinite, having no bounds or limits according to its uncreated essence, and thus it's incomprehensible to us, to creatures. The former, created being, is temporal. It began It began to be with time and exists in it. The latter, divine being, is without beginning or end and apart from all succession and change. That's Richard Muller. The former is dependent. The latter is independent. Creatures are contingent. Creation is contingent and God is not. John of Damascus said this long ago, all things are distant from God by nature. There's the creator-creature distinction. Divine nature and created nature are both distinct and different in kind. It's not a ladder of existence. God is at the top and we're just somewhere below him. It's a totally different ladder. Bringing things into being distinct from himself makes God the efficient cause of creation. That is, God and God alone, the triune God, remember, brought creation into existence without any change in God, the Trinity. We're going to kind of tease that out a little more. It's very important. According to one writer, I'm not sure if it's Edward Fesser or Fazer. I heard somebody say Fazer. Does anybody know? F-E-S-E-R? I probably shouldn't ask because somebody's going to go, isn't that guy a papist? He is, but he's helpful on this issue. An efficient cause, he says, is that which brings something into existence without change in the one who brought that which comes into existence. So with reference to God, this means that since he is pure act or not becoming or not able to become in any sense, God and God alone is able to bring about the existence of things without change in himself. Okay, if you are going to bring about the existence of larger biceps, some of you need to, you need to exert effort. There's going to be change in you as a goal, but also as a means to your goal, to your end. Not so with God. The execution of divine power does not make God what he is not. It reveals or manifests who he is. Creation is a work of God, bringing being into being, as Bob Inc. said, distinct from his own being. So the creator is of a different order of being from the creation. God is not like us. This distinction is crucial to maintain. Thomas Wayne Andy says, as creator, God is not one of the things created and is thus completely other than all else that exists. And Webster says this, the difference between creator and creature is infinite, not just very great. Creator does not merely refer to the supreme causal power by which the world is explained, for God would then be simply a principle superior to the world or the biggest thing around. I think I tweeted that once. God is not the biggest thing around. Of course, there's all kinds of pushback by neo-anthropomorphites. And it sounds weird. God's not the biggest thing around. He isn't. Such conceptions falter by making God one term in a relation, and so one term on the ladder, he just happens to be the highest, and so only comparatively, not absolutely different. God the Creator is not simply the most excellent of beings, because the distinction between uncreated and created being is not a distinction within created being, but one between orders of being. God is not one item in a totality, even the most eminently powerful item in the set of all things, unquote. So confessing divine simplicity in chapter 2, divine immutability in chapter 2, divine impassibility in chapter 2, means that God cannot change from within or from without because of what he is and what he is not. He is God, the simple and immutable creator. He is not in any sense a mutable creature. He doesn't become that which he is not in order to make that which he makes. He doesn't become a creature in any sense. He is, according to Muller, free from all mutation of being, attributes, place, or will. Now, of course, that's Muller's dictionary. So that's Muller interpreting the Reformed scholastics of the 16th and probably primarily the 17th century. God is free from all mutation, change of being. There's no change of being in God. He doesn't have mode of existence A, then mode of existence B, then mode of existence C, then mode of existence D. He just is. No change in attributes, no change in place, no change of will. He can and he does reveal who he is to creatures, but he does not refashion himself or add attributes or add perfections to do so. By creating, God does not become something he was not in order to reveal who he is. In the beginning, it pleased God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit to create or make in order to manifest. Okay? It pleased him to manifest. It pleased him to reveal who he was. It didn't please him to become something other than he was in order that he might be able to reveal. So creation, let me stop there. By creating, God does not become something he was not in order to reveal who he is. He simply reveals who he is by creation, by providence, and by grace. The relationship creatures have with him does not necessitate the creation and assumption of relational properties. Some claim that in our day. Though it does necessitate the use of analogical or relational language, in the case of Scripture, to and for us, indicating that he is near. So that's my brief definition and kind of interaction with a couple quotes. Now let's look at some definitions by others in the 17th century. It provides a background into the literature that helps us interpret some of the language used not only in the Westminster Confession but in ours as well. The first is Johannes Willibius. Thank you. In the early 17th century, Willibius defines creation as the act by which God made the world and all that is in it. Isn't that interesting? He doesn't say the universe. He says the world. Dr. Renahan knows this because I think he's the one that put me onto this. Our confession says the world. You go, well, he only made the world. What about something other than earth? World is comprehensive. In a lot of the literature, it means everything not God. The act by which God made the world and all that is in it, partly from nothing, and partly from unsuitable material, in order to reveal the glory of his power, wisdom, and goodness. So, creation was partly ex nihilo and partly not. Where did that other God worked with material? Creation has a material cause? Some matter that existed? Notice two things in this definition. First, Willibius distinguishes between creation partly from nothing and partly from unsuitable material. And he goes on to explain himself as follows. To create, this is a quote, to create means not only to make something out of nothing, but also to make something beyond the power of nature from unsuitable material. So there's creation ex nihilo. There's the material. And it's unsuitable in itself by virtue of the creative act to become something that it ends up becoming. Like dirt. Because what did dirt become? At least in part. Man, at least the body of man, right? There's nothing in creation ex nihilo itself, in the soil, that makes it natural for part of the soil to become Adam's body. It takes another act. It takes another divine act. These older writers, implicitly at least, deny any form of evolution. Because there was nothing natural in it to become what it ended up becoming. So it's a supernatural act of God on the existing material that he created ex nihilo and then he makes or forms into something else. He gives an example. Let me quote that again. To create means not only to make something out of nothing, but also to make something beyond the power of nature from unsuitable material. He gives an example of what he means by unsuitable material in these words. There was no quality or disposition in the dust that would have produced the human body, which was formed unnaturally and miraculously from it. His point is that the first human body was not caused out of nothing, immediately, and that from which it was formed had nothing in it from the act of creation ex nihilo that tended toward some sort of natural formation of man. So this makes any form of evolution with reference to man untenable. The second thing I want to highlight in this quote by Walibius is where he says that God created in order to reveal the glory of his power, wisdom, and goodness. You ever heard that before? Power, wisdom, and goodness. It's in 4:1. This triad is used by Walibius at least two other times in the context of discussing creation. So you have to put that in our memory bank, and because we're going to use that a little later. So when it shows up in Confessions, Walibius wrote before the Westminster Confession, it's not de novo, it's not brand spanking new, okay? There's a history of it. William Ames, also in the 17th century, Ames defines creation as follows. Creation is the efficiency or working power of God, whereby in the beginning, out of nothing, he made the world to be altogether good. The world again. He further asserts that creation refers to the whole world. That is, this is not me, this is him. That is, whatever exists outside of God. Thank you for that reference, by the way. Okay, what does the world mean in the confession? Most likely it means everything other than God. Defining the world as whatever exists outside of God, I think, gives us a glimpse into what is meant by the world, all that is not God. Then in good classical and orthodox Christian fashion, he says, nothing exists from eternity but God. And God is not matter or a part of any creature, but only the maker. So Ames distinguishes between what he calls active creation and passive creation. I think Dr. Renahan mentioned that, and I'm just going to skip that. You did mention that, right? Okay. Passive creation would be like man. There's something that already exists. Matter exists, but it doesn't exist in the form that it ended up existing in by virtue of another divine act. You can read the creation account and see passive creations happening recurrently. Turretin does the same thing, and I'm going to skip down to Turretin now. Moving from Ames to Turretin gives us more background as we're going on the chronological order here. Turretin would be the latest. More background of the discussions around the time frame of our confession. He begins his discussion of creation with these words. We intend now to speak of the transient and external acts called the works of God. In my first lecture, I used that language. We intend now to speak of the transient and external acts called the works of God by which he executes his decrees outside of himself. Turretin then distinguishes between the works of nature and grace. Nature referring to creatures and their natural ends, and grace referring to men and their supernatural ends, redemption. The works of nature are twofold, creation and providence. Turretin says, the first work of nature is creation, by which he formed out of nothing, as to its whole being, this entire universe, and all that is in it. And then in good Turretinian, if that's not a word, it is now, in good Turretinian fashion, he goes on to make distinctions. Creation may be either first and immediate, which is simply ex nihilo, or secondary and mediate, active and passive, using different words, which is made indeed from some matter. In other words, there are created things, then some things made or formed from those previously created things. He gives an example as man. Then he goes on to say this, there is no change made in God by creation. Nor is any new perfection added to him. Hence, whatever change was made by the creation was made in the creatures passing from non-existence to being and not in God himself creating. Now, that is very standard language among the older Reformed theologians. When they are seeking to distinguish between God and not God, God and creature, or all that is in God and all that is not God. But it's not standard language in our day. So I have a little excursus here. It's actually not a little excursus. It's a long one. It asks this question. Is God only the maker and not a part of any creature? That's Ames said that. An assertion made by Ames, the one I just quoted, is of interest to us in our day. And it's of interest because some are attempting to distinguish between divine modes of existence, given creation. I'm bringing it up because it's given creation. There's some sort of divine mode of existence that's altered, changed in order for creation to be and in order for God to interact with creatures. Note what Ames says. Nothing exists from eternity but God, and God is not matter or a part of any creature, but only the maker. God is only the maker and in no sense part of that which is made. That which is made comes into being. You can't say God comes into being. No aspect of God that comes into being. By the way, I'm not talking about the incarnation. That's chapter 8. We're in chapter 4. Now, focusing a bit more on denying change in God due to creation, here's what Turton said a long time ago. There is no change made in God by creation, nor is any perfection added to him. He doesn't add attributes. Hence, whatever change was made by the creation was made in the creatures, passing from non-existence to being, and not in God himself created. Now, similarly, Abrakel says this. The creative act does not bring about a change in God, but in the creature. It's pretty standard and simple to understand. The statements by Ames, Turretin, and Abrakel are reflective of the way older theologians spoke about the distinction between God and creatures. Now, let's consider two contemporary writers who, it seems to me and to others, do not, at least don't articulate their views in the same way that Ames, Turretin, and Abrakel did, and in fact, I think, steer away from the classical and even confessional Reformed position. Now, I chose these two writers due to their connection to the Westminster Confession. This isn't a personal thing. I don't know these men personally, but they're connected to the Westminster Confession, and they get books that are published. One of them has like dozens of books published, and he says things that are, I think, troubling. And because of that, I chose these two writers. But before stating and pushing back on their views, it may be helpful to remind ourselves that I am critiquing ideas, not individuals. Okay? I am critiquing proposals, not people. So, while doing this, I am not attacking the character of those with whom I disagree. I believe they're characters. I believe I'm a character, okay? But I'm not attacking their character. I believe they are wrong. And if they were here after the lecture, they would say, I believe you are wrong. And hopefully we could go eat some Argentine barbecue together. And then I'd get security on them. The views they propose, however, are not in step with their own theological tradition. And I think their tradition gets it right. So first of all, John Frame, he says this, my approach recognizes two modes of existence in God. You've probably heard that before. Previous to this statement, he says, the difference between God's atemporal and historical existences begins not with the creation of man, but with creation itself. You see why I chose this is because it's connected to the doctrine of creation. And you remember what Webster says. If you're going to account for the doctrine of creation, you better have a good doctrine of creator first, or else you're going to mess up. So let's consider these words, two modes of existence in God, and the difference between God's atemporal and historical existences begins with creation itself. I don't think this proposal works. I'm going to try to show you how. It certainly does not comport with the claims of Ames, Turretin, and Abrakel above, Here's another 17th century man, Francis, is it Chanel? F.C. Francis says this, "We must not conceive that God was first in a naked power of being and afterwards reduced or changed unto actual being by his own effectual power, as if his existence were really different from his essence as its proper cause." I'll speak more to this issue below. For now, remember what Frame claims, at least remember that. Frame claims at least one of God's modes of existence began, and it is different from his other mode of existence. Now, this, I think, entails that in some sense, God's existence is, in the words of Chanel, really different from his essence. If God is essentially whatever, but another mode of existence comes to be at some point, then you've separated divine existence, divine essence, and divine existence. Frame even says God's historical existence begins with creation itself. The historical mode of existence must be a derived existence, since it is not eternal, which entails something as derivatively divine in God due to creation. And I ask the question, isn't this a contradiction? This must be the case since it began and is therefore part of creation prior to man's existence. If God's so-called historical existence began with creation, it cannot be God's atemporal existence, right? Because there are existences, and the second one began to be prior to the creation of man. God's historical existence, therefore, came to be, and to come to be is a necessary and exclusive feature of what? Of a creature. Frame's view seems to entail that God came to possess a second mode of divine existence, which began to be with creation. Now, I have this long footnote. You might say, well, you're picking on Frame in a very obscure place of his writings. He doesn't say things like that in other areas. It was a bad day when he was writing. I have this really long footnote that shows Frame said some really awkward things, like, a relenting is part of the eternal, unchangeable, divine nature. That's almost a word-for-word quote. I read that the first time. I go, he doesn't mean what he's saying. Relenting, what's a synonym for that? Changing is a part of the eternal, unchangeable, divine nature. If you're interested, there's a review by Ryan McGraw of John Frame's Systematic Theology, and it was published in the Puritan Reformed Journal, Volume 8, 2, in 2016. And it's really scathing, but he's right. He shows a lot of ways where that John Frame says things that are difficult to draw the conclusion that it's in line with his own confession of faith. Now, another example, we'll get back to Frame in a minute. Another example of a contemporary author who argues for a change in the mode of God's existence due to creation is K. Scott Oliphant, Dr. Oliphant. He contends that, here's a quote, that God freely determined to take on attributes. That's not how the old guys talked, right? God doesn't take on things. That God freely determined to take on attributes, characteristics, and properties that he did not have and would not have without creation, unquote. Earlier in this discussion, Oliphant tells us that attributes, properties, and even perfections are used synonymously. It seems that he uses characteristics in the same sense. I'm going to discuss that a little later. God does this taking on in order to relate to man both prior to the incarnation of the Son and even for eternity. Here's what he says. He remains who he is but decides to be something else as well. He decides to be the God of the covenant. It was, to be sure, a monumental decision. It changed the mode of God's existence for eternity. He began to exist according to relationships ad extra, which had not been the case before. Note what Oliphant claims. The mode of God's existence changed for eternity. How so? Let's just grant it. We'll ask the question, how so? Well, an act of God, based on a decision of God, changed God forever. That is, God, it has to be this, God changed God. God willed a change of mode in divine existence, according to this view. Oliphant says, he began to exist according to the relationships ad extra. And we might ask the question, how can God remain who he is, but become something else as well, without some sort of addition in or to God? And the answer is, he can't. If God becomes something else as well, would this not entail some sort of composition in God, which is a denial of, or at least a compromise of, divine simplicity? It seems to me that it would. Listen to a Brockle who speaks to this very issue. He says, since we must recognize, however, that all composition implies imperfection, dependency, and divisibility, we must not think of God as being composite, even in the remotest sense of the word. Now, how should we respond to this? Very carefully indeed. I was driving this morning, and I actually thought about praying, believe it or not. And I was praying, and one of the things I prayed for was that I would be humble and gracious, but firm and clear. If I didn't think this was important, I wouldn't have delivered it. Matter of fact, at one point, I decided not to deliver this material, but for various reasons, concluded that it would be helpful. So I think we need to respond to it, if for no other reason than it is quite at odds with the long-held view that God's existence, that he is, and God's essence, what he is, are coextensive. We'll discuss that a little. The fact that God is, and that which God is, though they may be distinguished, must never be separated. Muller defines the essence of God as follows: the whatness of God. God is the only necessary self-existent being, or in other words, the only being in whom existence and essence are inseparable. It is of the essence or whatness of God that God exists. Now note these words well. God is the only being in whom existence and essence are inseparable. This, according to Muller, is reflective of the position of Protestant scholastic theology, and certainly reflected in the Westminster Confession, Savoy Declaration, and ours. God does not take on new being. In fact, he does not have being, as if being were something without God added to him to make him to be who he is. God just is his being. In the 17th century, Chanel put it this way: we must not conceive as if his existence were really different from his essence, or did virtually flow from and consequently depend upon his essence as its proper cause. So there cannot be a consequent aspect of God's existence dependent upon his essence. There isn't a part of God that's derived later on. Voss says this: there is no distinction in God between essence and existing, between essence and being, between essence and substance, between substance and its attributes. God is most pure and most simple act. Voss then poses this question: may we make a distinction in God between his being and his attributes? His answer is no. And I think he's right. Voss's point is that given divine simplicity, God isn't composed in any sense, an ontological distinction cannot be established between what is essentially God and what God reveals himself to be. There's no such thing as derivative divinity. God, in no sense whatsoever, comes to be. There are not varying existences of God, one of which is not coextensive with the very essence of God. In other words, Voss would disagree with Frame's proposal, and I think Oliphant's as well, utilizing the doctrine of divine simplicity and the coextensive concepts of divine existence and essence. I'm going fast because I have a lot of material. But I say the same thing over and over and over, so if you don't get it now or haven't gotten it yet, hopefully you'll get it soon. Now, these proposals by these men entail that all that is in God is not God eternally. Or it could be put this way, some feature in God is not God eternally. Contrary to this proposal, however, God does not begin to be in any sense whatsoever. Divine existence and essence are coextensive, and God's existence does not, quoting Chanel, flow from and consequently depend upon his essence as its proper cause. God does not cause any feature of his existence to come to be, but if his so-called historical existence or his condescended mode of existence are real, and if either came to be with creation, then they were caused to be, either with creation or, I think, as creation itself. Charnock says, God is what he is from eternity and cannot be otherwise. God being, this is Charnock again, God being infinitely simple hath nothing in himself which is not himself. Isn't it funny how Charnock read Dolezal's book? God, being infinitely simple, hath nothing in himself which is not himself, and therefore cannot will any change in himself. He, being his own existence, essence and existence. Though God, Charnock again, though God always remains in regard of existence, he would be immortal and live always, yet, if he should suffer any change, he could not properly be eternal, because he would not always be the same, and would not in every part be eternal, for all change is finished in time, one moment preceding, another moment following. But that which is before time cannot be changed by time. God cannot be eternally what he was, that is, he cannot have a true eternity if he had a new knowledge, a new purpose, a new essence, if we were sometimes this and sometimes that, sometimes know this and sometimes know that, sometimes purpose this and afterwards hath a new purpose. He would be partly temporary and partly eternal, not truly and universally eternal. He that hath anything of newness hath not properly a truly and entire eternity. That's very standard old language. Both that God is and what God is, he is eternally and by nature. God does not will himself to come to be. He is not his own cause, though God is the alone sufficient ground of his existence. God does not cause divine existence to be. He's not his own efficient cause. He exists and in no sense comes to be. As Abrakel says, the essence of God is his eternal self-existence. Listen to Burkhoff. God is self-existent, that is, he is the ground of his existence, he has the ground of existence in himself. This idea is sometimes expressed by saying that he is his own cause. But this expression is hardly accurate, since God is the uncaused who exists by the necessity of his own being, and therefore necessarily, and I would add, eternally. God does not effect God. If God possesses a second mode of existence, his historical mode, or a singular mode which he changed in order to create and or relate to that which he creates, his condescended mode, then the second mode was caused to be, or the singular, though willed to be changed mode, was caused to be. This entails some sort of chronology within God's being. Listen to Abrakel again. He says, there can be no chronology. If you thought, wow, that was a good one, Barcellus, that chronology thing, you're sharp. Now you know where I got it from. But you say it first, and then you quote somebody else. This entails some sort of chronology within God's being. Listen to Abrakel. There can be no chronology within the being of God, since his being is simple and immutable. Bob Inc. again. Indeed, the idea of becoming predicated of the divine being is of no help in theology. Isn't that great? There's a longer quote. I'm going to skip it. The claim is made by Oliphant, however, that God changed his mode of existence for eternity. This, then, is something God decided to become. This occurred due to creation, as with frame. Because of creation and God's desire to relate to it covenantally, God takes on that which he had not prior to creation. This means that whatever he takes on, Dr. Oliphant calls them attributes, characteristics, properties, and perfections in various places, they are must be themselves created. He even acknowledges that in this long quote. I'm going to skip that. Now, a fundamental problem with both of these proposals seems to be related to the creator-creature distinction. In an effort to account for divine immanence, God is with us, Oliphant's proposal entails that God, revealing himself to creatures, cannot be both transcendent and immanent in the classical sense, and so must become something prior to the incarnation of the Word, prior to the incarnation of the Son. He must become something he was not prior to the creation of all things. God acts in this new manner of existence in order to reveal himself to and to interact with us, in his words, for eternity. Now, this assumes, I think, a problem with divine transcendence, and I think divine infinity, and we'll look at that in a minute. It assumes a problem with divine transcendence. God's being is wholly other than created being. And the two, there has to be a bridge, or else the twain shall never meet. You know what Aquinas said? The bridge has been built already. It's called creation. But this assumes there's a problem with divine transcendence and, I think, infinity if God is going to reveal himself to creatures. In fact, according to Cam Porter, chief of security, Mr. Clean, we had to rip his earrings out before he came in today. Oliphant as much as admits this. Listen, this is from a review article that we published in the new journal, the 2017 journal, that Cam did. And here's what he says, and I think he's right. He says, repeating a particular formula of, quote, in order to, unquote, and, quote, so that he could, that is, so that God could, when articulating his conception of divine condescension, Oliphant suggests that there is a problem of the distance of God which God needs to voluntarily overcome because it constitutes, this is a quote, because it constitutes a boundary between the being of God and the being of creation. Whether necessitated or assumed freely, Oliphant assumes the latter, this amounts to God having another manner in which he exists, an acquired mode of being that affords him the ontological conditions by which he can interact with his creation. Contrary to Oliphant's assertion, this is still Porter, the answer to the question of how this transcendent God can be in true and relational immanence is not found in the taking on of ontological newness in order to relate, but in the fact that God is able to relate because of who he is ontologically, without the need of intermediary actuality. In the beginning, it pleased God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit for the manifestation of his own glory to tinker with himself in order that he might. It doesn't say that. It assumes the very God of chapter 2. Now, I think Cam's right, and here's why. In the book that Cam is referring to by Dr. Oliphant, The Majesty of Mystery, Celebrating the Glory of an Incomprehensible God, we find statements like this. By the way, this book was written after God with Us. God with Us is like 2012. This one might be 2000. This is 2016, published in 2016. Here's what we hear in that book. There is then a distance of being between God and man. Agreed. How can the infinite one relate to finite creatures? Okay, that he's saying, basically, because I read the book, there's a problem with the infinite one relating to finite creatures. There is a problem for us, he says, not for God, of this distance, which distance constitutes a boundary between the being of God and the being of creation. The problem of distance and the dilemma of God's relationship to creation is no problem or dilemma for God. So the reason why the problem of distance is not a problem for God is found in God himself. For, in the words of Oliphant, the absolute... I hope everybody had coffee this morning. Listen to what he says. The absolute... I'll explain this. The absolute and the relative exist, first and foremost, in the triune God himself. Now, what does he mean? By absolute, Oliphant intends what God is essentially, or, quote, God's characteristics as God, and thus quite apart from creation. Okay? So there we have God in himself. But notice what he says, and I said this is a quote, God's characteristics as God, and thus quite apart from creation. He doesn't say God's attributes, God's perfections. He says God's characteristics. In that book, there are dozens of times when he could have used attributes, perfections, but he used characteristics almost every time. And you have to ask yourself, characteristics, aren't those like accidental qualities that can change? Like that character right there? And this character right here? Why do we say that about God? Anyway, he lists among these absolute characteristics, God's infinity, eternity, immutability, and impassibility. And I have all the page numbers. What he intends by relative, remember the absolute and the relative exist first in God. What he means by the relative, what he intends by relative is the characteristics that God has because of his voluntary condescension. He also labels these as God's covenantal characteristics. He says some of those relative or covenantal characteristics are now permanent. What's the assumption? Some of them aren't. But they're now permanent. They weren't in existence before he took them on. E.g., he says, for example, grace and wrath. Some only temporary. E.g., that is, for example, theophanies, human forms, appearances as fire in the Old Testament. So the distance, this is me, so the distance of being between God and man is bridged by God himself. God remains infinite, eternal, immutable, and impassible in his essential characteristics, but he also must be viewed as, quote, expressing himself in new characteristics in order to relate to us. Now, you know, what gets related to us? God, capital G, or God, small created God? You have to ask those kind of questions, at least you should. And both God's absolute and relative character exist in God. Remember he said they exist first in God himself. Recall these words of Oliphant. The absolute and the relative exist. They really are, whatever these absolute and relative qualities or characteristics are, first and foremost in the triune God himself. If the relative is not infinite, eternal, immutable, and impassible as the absolute, and it can't be, this entails it is finite, temporal, mutable, and passable. Matter of fact, in God with us, Dr. Oliphant says, there must be some real and fundamental sense in which God can have and experience passions. But if the relative really exists in the triune God himself, then in the words of Cam, God assumed, here's a quote, an acquired mode of being that affords him the ontological conditions by which he can interact with his creation. And thus, this is me, the boundary or the distance of being has been bridged by this acquisition of a new mode of being. The answer to Oliphant's question, how can the infinite one relate to finite creatures, seems to be that the infinite one assumes finitude in himself. Now, Oliphant's thesis assumes an ontological problem that must be overcome. He says, there is a boundary between the being of God and the being of creation. But is there such a problem or boundary? Listen to what Ian MacFarlane says. He asserts that there is no sort of ontological barrier that might limit God's intimacy with creation. Bob Inc. says, implied in creation is both God's transcendence and God's immanence. Implied in creation is God's not creature, transcendence, and God is here, immanence. You realize that God's here whether we recognize it or not? And God doesn't appear to us like the appearances of God in the Old Testament or even the New Testament. It's not as if God's absent to his creation and then he becomes present in his creation. God doesn't change. God's not limited by time or space. God changes things. It seems to me that both Frame and Oliphant assume a working tenet of forms of what some call theistic personalism or mutualism. Namely, given classical Christian theism, there are ontological features in the eternal God which must be overcome if divine immanence is to be. Now, process theism sees a fundamental metaphysical continuity between God and all that is not God. This is denied by Frame and Oliphant. But process theism further asserts that only if God and the world, I'm quoting somebody, only if God and the world operate on the same metaphysical plane is it possible for God to engage the world both directly and without compulsion. But is God an ontological boundary or barrier which must be overcome if he is to reveal himself to creatures and interact? Is it the case that there is a boundary between the being of God and the being of creature? I don't think so. MacFarlane is surely correct when he says God's engagement with the world is neither impeded by nor subject to the metaphysics of becoming. God does not become in order to create or manifest himself to creatures. Creation manifests God to creatures. I have to edit on my feet here. There's another problem. I'm just skipping over some stuff here. There's another problem with Oliphant's proposal. God condescended and God as infinite and eternal seem to be two modes of existence or orders of being. One temporal and contingent and the other eternal and non-contingent or uncreated. The condescended mode of existence comes about due to a boundary between God and creatures. The boundary is God himself. Oliphant says, there is a boundary between the being of God and the being of creation. How does God overcome the problem of the distance of God? He condescends. Quote, he remains who he is, but decides to be something else as well. So what gets revealed to us in order to overcome this boundary is the condescended covenantal mode of being, a mode of being not coextensive with who God is essentially and eternally. But I would argue, God has no newly produced attributes. He has no produced attributes whatsoever. Now, in the Majesty of Mystery, I think I already said this, Dr. Oliphant uses the term character or characteristics instead of the more conventional attribute or attributes on many, many occasions. And I'm not going to tell you about that. I'm just going to state it. I think there are reasons for it, but I'm going to get on so I can finish. What happened with all the time? Now, it appears to me, what's going on here? It appears to me that both Frame and Oliphant are basically attempting the same thing. And I think it's a novel, not novel, but a noble thing that they're trying to do. They're trying to account for divine immanence with creatures given divine transcendence. To do this, they both posit some sort of divine change, that God relates himself to creatures by adding to or acting upon himself. So in some sense, God is the effect of his own action, a self-decreed and actuated being, at least in part, both a first and a second cause. Thanks to Cam for that. But as Webster assures us, God's simplicity excludes any relation to creatures in which God receives an augmentation of his being. God does not augment God to be God with us. He augments creatures to reveal to them that he is near. Frame and Oliphant end up compromising both divine immutability and divine simplicity. It appears to me that One of their motivations is to account for what has traditionally been termed metaphorical language, and specifically the anthropomorphic and anthropopathic scriptural assertions predicated of God. This is certainly a commendable thing. Both, however, seem to view the traditional manner of explaining these metaphorical assertions as wrong and in need of reform. Let me reframe here. Theologians have sometimes described God's relenting as anthropomorphic. There's something true in that description. Some of you have read enough Frame to know he's setting me up. Now what is he going to say? But the historical process does change. And as an agent in history, God himself changes. On Monday, he wants something to happen. And on Tuesday, something else. He is grieved one day, pleased the next. In my view, anthropomorphic is too weak a description of these narratives. In these accounts, God is not merely like an agent in time. He really is in time, changing as others change. And we should not say that his atemporal, changeless existence is more real than his changing existence in time, as the term anthropomorphic suggests. Both are real. Here's what Dr. Oliphant says. Much of systematic theology is done especially in theology proper, needs a complete revision and rewrite. This statement was made in the context of Dr. Oliphant advocating that we be fearlessly anthropomorphic in our formulations of the doctrine of God. Oliphant expressed several brilliant theologians were wrong, Augustine, Aquinas, Charnock, Paul Helm, Bob Inc., because they failed to be fearlessly anthropomorphic. Now, in The Majesty of Mystery, after identifying various Old Testament theophanies, he says this: there's an abundance of literature that deals with these issues, much of which can be pursued with great profit. However, even some of the best theologians in the history of the church misstep when pressed with questions like the ones above. The question is this: how can God walk in the garden and appear to Abraham if he is spirit with no body? Unfortunately, examples are almost too numerous to list. Then he offers Augustine, Charnock, and Bob Inc. as examples, and he says, as admirable as these motives are, however, it is not in keeping with biblical language and emphases to think, speak, or write in such ways as these great theologians have done. We have to find a better way to interpret biblical passages dealing with God and his relations to the world. Now, that's in the context of anthropomorphic or anthropopathic assertions of Scripture, things predicated of God that are creaturely. And both of them are saying is, we know it's been done. We know how they dealt with it. We think they're wrong. We need to change the way we interpret those passages. Now, it should be obvious by now that Oliphant does not agree with the traditional, classical, and reformed account of many of the metaphorical assertions of Scripture pertaining to God. Indeed, it appears that he views his book, The Majesty of Mystery, as articulating a better way to interpret biblical passages dealing with God and his relations to the world. Those are his words. We must find a better way, and his book is trying to provide a better way. So he views his book as that better way. Now, we must admit that there are many difficult issues presented to us by the language of Scripture when it comes to assertions about God, like he has fingers and wings. Our interest in the language of Scripture, however, is not the mere words used, but the divine intent of the words used. So what's going on behind some of these statements? I think both men see the traditional Reformed, and I'd say classical Christian way of at least on the main, of interpreting some of the metaphorical statements of Scripture, they're wrong. We can't do it that way. It doesn't work. So what do they put in place? They put a second mode of divine existence, God becoming something in order to create and make or reveal himself. They don't deny the eternal aspects of God in himself. He's infinite. He's eternal. He's immutable. He's impassible. But they say there's this second mode. I don't think it works.